Welcome to the Student of the Game Fire Podcast with your host, Danny B. Today's guest is Kurt Isaacson, 33 years of career experience, second generation firefighter, creator and owner of CFT, County Fire Tactics, and recently retired battalion chief with Escambia County Fire Rescue in Florida. If you don't know anything about Kurt, I implore you to listen to the weekly scrap episodes he's been on where you can find more information on his knowledge, on tactics, and the fire service as a whole. The interview between Kurt and I is more directly related to why he believes and thinks the way he does. Kurt is one of the main reasons why my mindset towards the job is the way it is. Against others' opinions and beliefs, the biggest takeaway from this interview is to be patient and true to yourself. With that, I present Kurt Isaacson.
Kurt Isaacson here with County Fire Tactics. Thanks for having me on. I grew up in a house, you know, a fire family, if you will. My dad was retired military, but he joined the Midway Fire Department in 1971. So since before I can remember, I was going to the firehouse, you know, riding on calls. I experienced my first civilian fire fatality in 1971, riding in the back of a 1971 Volvo station wagon, a two-story house on Laurel Drive, just a few miles from where I still live now. And my dad had explained to me why, they were putting a man in a body bag. I didn't know it was a body bag at the time, but I grew up, you know, hanging out at the firehouse weekends, nighttime. It's fully paid fire department now, but back then it was volunteer. But it was very structured, organized, based on my dad and the other leaders were military personnel. We're very big military in Northwest Florida, from Pearl Harbor Air Force Base, Eglin, home of the Blue Angels. So it was even in the 70s, there was like a training calendar, for the volunteer fire department. Had a waiting list, totally different than it is today. So very structured. From riding assignments to people, you know, officers assigned to certain rigs in the firehouse, that sort of thing. So take away, there was no paycheck. It was a very structured deal. I got my first set of bunker gear on May 21st, 1988. Pull-up boots, you know, long, I call it the backdraft coat, and the Philly, you know, style turtle shell helmet. All I wanted was a New Yorker helmet at the time. But I'd already been sitting in classes like the Florida State Fire College classes in elementary, middle school. And then once that May 21st, 1988 hit, I was going to classes all the time. Started in high school doing dual enrollment at Pensacola State College, taking fire science classes at night, even when I was still in high school. And then right out of high school, I went straight to the Florida State Fire College, where my dad sent me to get not only my Florida standards, minimum standards, but I got my fire officer one, arson investigator, fire inspector, and then my first paid job was actually a fire inspector. My dad really encouraged me to have something to fall back on if I got injured at a young age. So he got me into training as a junior firefighter. I would head up, lead, teach the programs for the 20 junior firefighters, whether it be hands-on at the drill tower. And then I got into fire inspections. My dad was real big into fire prevention, codes enforcement. So, that was the foundation of me getting the fire service, was fire inspections and training, which has, you know, been, a great thing my entire, career. So really this is all I've ever done my whole life, is the fire department, you know, dating back to, a kid. I mean, numerous times I've worked for two fire departments at the exact same time, Mary Esther and Pensacola. I did 9 years with Pensacola, got hired by Escambia, did both those jobs for a few years, was literally pulling down 56 hours a week. Pensacola on a 24-48, my 2 days off, I was going to the county pulling a 45-hour work week. So I was doing 101 hours a week. The only way I was off during those few years was if I took, you know, basically sick leave or annual leave. Other than that, I was working all the time.
Okay. So obviously second generation firefighter, and pretty much you knew that's what you wanted to be from the moment you were riding with your father going to calls.
Oh, absolutely. The only other thing I ever had interest in was, you know, being a pilot. In 1989, I stayed at the Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs, Colorado for a week for a like a USAR type program for the Boy Scouts of America, but it was fire related. We did swift water rescue, rope rescue, and all that. So, you know, for a little bit, I was kind of, you know, interested in being a pilot, but, you know, pretty much 90%+ was always fire. The only other thing I was ever interested in was, you know, military, being a pilot, just based on Northwest Florida's home of naval aviation. And, you know, just, you know, my whole family's, you know, pro-military.
Okay. So with that being said, you got on your first department. Did you seek out the individuals that you wanted to emulate, or did your father have a way in telling you, hey, upon walking into these doors of this station, find the guys that are into the job? Was that a priority for you?
Well, absolutely. You know, my father was a little bit older. I always kid around that I was an accident, you know, near the end of Vietnam War, but my sister's 13 years older than me. But like, being raised by a military father, my mom was also Air Force. And so, you know, they were pro being open-minded, pro, you know, training, you know, and just, you know, everybody can offer something. So, you know, I was absolutely, you know, raised to seek out people that are going to make me better, people that have, you know, like-minded. So that was, you know, pretty easy. And I was exposed to positive people. And then I grew up being a huge FDNY buff. You know, I almost went up and tested 30 some years ago with the FDNY. I didn't. My two boys are actually on the list now for the FDNY. But, you know, I just would seek out those that I thought were squared away, you know, people, just good character, you know, into the job, into their families. And it just kind of went from there. And then I was just, you know, very fortunate enough in the 90s to start going to FDIC when it went to Indianapolis. I was involved at the Florida State Fire College as an adjunct instructor, helping burn trailers and stuff like that with some individuals that were involved with a guy named Dominic Coletti that actually worked for Hell Corporation. I think he invented the CAS system. And so early on in my career, I was connected with the go-getters, the, you know, movers and shakers, those in the fire service, that it wasn't just a job. It's what they did 7 days a week. So I've always been spoiled. That's how we built CFT team, was just the connections and relationships with the right people.
Okay. So at what point in your career did you decide to start moving up the ranks, and why?
I'm not sure if I ever really decided. I'd have been happy to be a firefighter my entire career, you know, riding backwards, you know, being on the nozzle or holding the Halligan tool. You know, I think the promotions was just based on how I was raised. You know, if you want to make a bigger difference, you want to have more influence, you know, the law of the lid, the law of influence, you know, by John Maxwell, rank definitely happens. You can definitely make change and influence, but it's easier when you're sitting in the meetings. And then the other factor is, as much as I love the job, I still, I knew I wanted to have a family. Then I started having a family, and, you know, promotion does involve additional pay and money. So I'm not being selfish. It's not just about me going to fires. I am, you know, providing, and I wanted my wife to be able to stay home and raise the kids. So it was a two-factor thing: influence, change to make it better for others, to provide solid leadership. But also the financial aspect was in the equation as well.
Okay. All right. In your opinion, what does the term aggressive mean to you?
Moving with purpose, action, results oriented. You want a football team. I hope this Saturday, the Florida Gators are aggressive when I'm there and watching them in the swamp, you know, you know, aggressive is not reckless. Aggressive is not dangerous. Default back to the Art of War by Sun Tzu. You know, surround the enemy, overwhelm them with so much force they don't even know what hit them. You know, that's aggressive. A fully involved garage fire with a 2.5 from the exterior to building in a stationary position with one firefighter, I call that aggressive. You know what I mean? You're hitting it with big water to suppress it in the shortest period of time. So, I think aggressive is just positive oriented.
Okay.
Well said.
When it comes to actually, as you started moving up the ranks, and you know, whether it was lieutenant, captain, obviously battalion chief, when it comes to leadership, what kind of leader did you want to be for the crews that worked for you?
It's easy just to say servant leadership, but I just wanted to be the leader that inspired and motivated other people. I wanted to be a leader that, had people see vision, not my vision, but see vision of a better fire service, vision of a more enjoyable fire service that was fulfilling, rewarding, that produced positive results when it comes to saving lives, stopping property loss, and what our mission statement is. And I think that that's, what leadership's about. It's about being that motivational coach to get people to do more than sometimes maybe they think they can do. And then they, in the end, they enjoy the results.
Okay. With your experience of shifting from one department to the next, there are plenty of individuals out there who I'm sure are going through the same thing. What advice can you give them if they feel like the current organization or department that they're in, they're just not being fulfilled?
They got to seek out, people in their local area within their region. You just can't go to fire conferences every week, but you have to find your own way of staying in tune and into the job. As a young firefighter, we didn't have the internet, but I think I got like seven publications in the mail: Fire Chief, Firehouse, Fire Rescue, Fire Engineering, all those NFPA Journal, the West Coast Fire Magazine. So I was looking at those fire magazines. I was fortunate enough to get my hands on the hot shots, the VHS tapes back then. But now it's so easy to get stuff on social media, YouTube. But just hang out with like-minded people. Don't let those in the firehouse say, "Ah, we get paid the same whether we go to a fire or not." No fire's still burning. Just let that go in one ear and out the other. It's not even worth letting them get you worked up. And just be fulfilling for yourself. Like don't be seeking somebody else's approval, if you will, about your love for the job. Like in the 90s, I was the one to push to get radio straps in Pensacola. I pushed to get leather boots before anybody else did. I was the first one to wear a leather helmet, and it wasn't that I was wanting to be the first person. I didn't mind being the first person. I was not embarrassed, if you will. So I think those are the key things. It does help when you can go to a fire conference and hang out with those that keep you going. I think that's a big part of CFT team, is a lot of our folks come to be a part of the CFT team so they can get that, that motivation to go back for another 3 months, 4 months, 5 months, whatever it is. Watch podcasts like yours and just realize there are a large number of us that love this job 24/7, and you don't have to just get that from when you're at your firehouse. But I do think that, within reason, and I said it last night on a doc talk, like you do have to think about pensions, pay and benefits. But I would say now more than ever before, life is short. It is very short, and it's not worth it, it's not worth it to be unhappy for an extended period of time. My dad always told me you can only ride one fire truck at a time. And I've always said, one station fire department, you can be happy and have a great time, but you are limited. I mean, you're not getting relocated to another station. You're subject to that. So there are pros to bigger fire departments because you can work in different parts of the city, different parts of the county. It's a higher percentage chance that you're going to be able to find people that love it like you do. There are smaller departments that really nobody on the job is really into the job. But you get a big job, a big department, you're going to have people that love it. There's just a higher percentage chance when you start dealing with 100, 200, 500, 1,000 plus firefighters that there's going to be people and there's going to be room for opportunity, to have a bigger fools group, if you will. People that want to have a benevolent association to put on a training conference once a year. So I have kind of slowly changed my thought process that people that are into this job big time, don't be scared to go test with the big city. Don't be scared to go test, with another department. And I think a lot of things that are helping that is like people now are doing 401ks where you're not locked into a pension system.
Okay. Those that are into the job obviously attend conferences, go to classes, FDIC, whatever they can get their hands on that their own organization can't give them. And it's no fault to the organization. It's all on dynamics, demographics, geographic location. So when you're into the job, you slowly, and you allow others to know, you slowly start having a target-ish, or people start looking at you more, trying to see whether you're being 100% genuine or if this is a fluke, or sometimes whatever, it's jealousy, whatever the case may be. What advice can you give to those who are outspoken about being into the job, but also embracing the fact that they're now under the microscope?
I'm very familiar with that. I've been a target for a long time. Be yourself, be true to yourself. It's okay. I'm glad not everybody loves the job. We wouldn't be as special, if everybody loved it. Too many people are seeking other people's approval, and they're seeking popularity, and that's just a false way of living. I mean, you got to be true to yourself, and you just got to learn to just like, you know what I mean? Really, they're just trying to get a rise out of you. And I can tell you what's happened with me is more so now there's a large number of people that maybe used to, pick on me or kid me or razz me, some of it out of love or whatever. And now, they've come back 20 plus years later and said, you know what, Ike, you did it right. You were into the job. You loved the job. You got more out of it than just a paycheck. You got more out of it, you know what I mean, just than the benefit and pension package. And I wish I would have taken your ride a little bit more. Or, hey, no matter what we said, we always appreciated having you on the box alarm for the fire because we knew you probably had the answers. So, those are just things. But, anybody that's doing something above average, beyond above the minimum standard, that's going to be elite, it's going to be a target. I mean, why do people hate Tom Brady? I mean, why do people hate, Messi, the soccer player? Because it's questionable if they're great. I just think it's funny people debate on if LeBron James or Michael Jordan's the best. I mean, Michael Jordan's always going to be the best because I'm a Bulls guy from the 90s. But, it's one of those things that everybody wants to be elite, and we want to focus on the elite, but we'll spend more energy criticizing, ridiculing, picking apart the elite and how somehow they maybe just got it. It was given to them. It was inherited instead of just spending the time on maybe you getting into the job or being better. And I absolutely positively know it's a fact that the better you are at this job, the more you're going to enjoy going on calls. I don't like people's houses burning down. I don't like, people getting injured and killed. But if it's going to happen, I want to be on duty and I want to be there because I've given my life to being the best I can be. I like that challenge and a reward of being able to stop property loss, to make a difference on, preventing somebody's injuries from being fatal. So, the more that somebody's into it, nobody wants to sit on the bench. Everybody wants to be on a start and play. Everybody, when there's 4 seconds left on the clock, you want to be able to feel comfortable to get the ball and shoot that three pointer before the buzzer. So it's easy just to sit back, like the whole man in the arena thing. It's easy to watch, but have you been down in the arena doing the fight? And you know what it's like to go a full, 4 quarters, a full round, a full 90 minutes of playing, soccer. I mean, most people know it's just all they've done is they just watch it on TV and they got the answers, even though they've never thrown a football.
Yeah, for sure. Okay. All right. CFT, how did that whole notion come about? Was this something that a friend of yours was like, hey, we should do this. We should bring this down to the Florida area? Or was this something through your experiences in traveling that you formulated that I'm going to start this training cadre?
Well, I grew up being a big urban city firefighter buff, if you will. I've always, wanted to be an urban city firefighter. I think that, that's where our textbooks come from. That's where foundational tactics come from. And so when Escambia County consolidated and took 16 volunteer fire departments to become one county fire department, it's a metro county, 350,000 people. And in the late 90s, that was starting to happen. Now I'd already thought of like, county fire tactics is different than urban tactics or suburban tactics. Because, in a county, we have over 100 high rises. We have urban areas based on the census of more than 1,000 people per square mile. We have suburban and we have rural. So we have a little bit of everything. We have places where we can put 24 people on the fire ground in less than 7 minutes. We have places where, the first fire truck might take 15 minutes to get there. So I was already thinking county fire tactics, as the county was becoming a paid department and analyzing what I want to be a part of it. When I got hired as the first training officer in March of 2000, I was like, this is county fire tactics. And at the time, county fire tactics as it is today didn't exist as a website or a training company. But when I was March of 2000, I was teaching, I'm like, okay, we're a county fire department that we're gonna have to evolve into county fire tactics of when are you pulling up and you get there 4 minutes after dispatch and you got rigs, piling up on top of you. And when are you running into the rural area and you're going to be 15 minutes to get there and the next backup rig's going to be 10 more minutes, and understanding that, the rigs will be, pretty much the same in all those areas outside of maybe a tanker coming. So that was evolving. Then in 2006, I started teaching at FDIC. 2006, I got contracts with South Okaloosa, but down by Panama City, Destin, 30A, South Walton, Okaloosa Island, Ocean City, Wright, Mary Esther, all those departments. I had a contract with all of them, and I was their the coordinator to coordinate the train. Those were all different fire departments, and 6 days a month I would go down there from 2006 to 2012 as a contract training coordinator to train all those fire departments. Where I would teach, like at Okaloosa Island, a rig from Destin would come to their station, a rig from Fort Walton would come to their station, and a rig from Ocean City, right? So, I'd have three or four fire departments in one room, but they're all separately paying me is the way it worked. I invoiced them all different, but I was in essence the coordinator training officer for South Okaloosa. So once again, now I'm in a county setting, if you will, they're on automatic aid, even though they're not one fire department. So we fast forward in February of 2009, Escambia's fire chief gets fired. I was the acting deputy chief. They said I was fired, but I was still protected, so they couldn't fire me. And that was when 2009, I purchased the website or the domain name countyfiretactics.com. And I said, we're just going to call it County Fire Tactics or County Fire Training. We're back and forth. And so that's how it evolved. And with, I was already doing contract training. I was already teaching at FDIC every year. I was teaching at Orlando Fire Conference, traveling around. And then 2010 or 2011, I did Water on the Fire. It was a one-day seminar on Pensacola Beach. I actually spent more on the projector and screen than it cost to buy them. That's the kind of money they charge you at convention spaces. Coffee, I had no clue coffee's expensive at a convention center. And then Ray McCormick and I did urban to suburban. JJ Cassetta and I did truck company operations, and I was just doing one-day seminars, learning how to do it. Then I started doing 2 days, and then we did a 3-day command officer boot camp, 2012, 2013, something like that. Maybe that was 2011, but and then obviously 2013 we did HROC and we did it for 10 consecutive years, and so it just kind of evolved over a period of time. And none of it could have happened if it wasn't for a large number of phenomenal nationally recognized speakers, authors. Specifically Mike Lombardo was a huge impact on me. Helping build the foundation of it. He was the first person I contacted when we developed the County Fire Tactics Officer Development Program that still runs now. It runs every year, first part of January. So, it's a team effort. With the CFT is not a person. It's not me. CFT is a group. It's a team of people. And I would hope, and if something happened to me tomorrow, it would carry on for years to come without me.
Okay. Affecting change. a lot of firefighters want to do something great for their organizations, and it's frustrating to those into the job where you have an idea, you explain it, and it doesn't happen overnight. Nothing happens overnight. So my question to you is, affecting change with how you've done officer boot camp, riding assignments, booster backup, water on the fire. What advice can you give to individuals, whether it could be any of those topics or just something that they want to improve within their fire department? How would they go about doing that?
Write one word on a sticky note and put it on the mirror in their bathroom. Patience. It's that simple. It's patience. You got to believe in it and you got to be patient. It's like having kids, and you don't think they're listening, you don't think they're listening, you don't think they're listening. And then a decade or two goes by, they become adults, and you're like, oh shit, they were listening to me. You know what I mean? Because you see it in how they live their life and the decisions they make. And it's just, it's staying true to what you believe and not seeking validation. You can't, you're not always going to be validated. If you come up with something new, innovative, that you truly believe in, people don't like change. You know what I mean? And then when they change, they don't want to change back. But change is just inevitable. It's literally taking over 20 years for the fire service, even on a small fraction, to buy into the booster backup fast attack. I believed in it since the 90s. I mean, when I went to Escambia, March of 2000, it was the first thing that I advocated was, like how long our water will last on a normal house fire attack. How much water was in the tank versus how much square footage is the house fire. And now we're talking 25 years later, and it's actually getting a little bit of traction. It's getting a little bit of teeth. And it's, moving forward now. I've kind of, I'm in like, the third edition where I talk about 6 and 6 minutes and 8 and 8 minutes and people before water, which is really just the gallons per second program, which is really just the booster backup program. It's just marketing. But it's, that whole 10 pounds of pressure. 100% of the time, and just realizing that you're gonna have to be patient. Firefighters don't understand a 5-year plan. They sure as hell don't understand a 10-year plan, a 20-year plan. And it's hard for people to grasp that some things that we're gonna do is not for us, it's for the next generation. And for me now it's a little bit easier because my boys are in the fire service. I didn't think they would be, but they are, so it's kind of gratifying. But whether you have kids or not, or whether your kids are going to go in the fire service, we should all want to be able to leave and in retirement come back to a picnic, a dinner, see it on the news, and say, you know what, man, I left a mark there. And it's not about you, but you left a mark to make it better, to make it move forward and an impression. And so, I think that we're going to continue to make the fire service better, and we need people to continue to ask questions like, why is the second new rig always called a hydrant? I can tell you, it's simple. It's right out of Kimbrell's book. It's the steamer and pumper. Back in the day, the steamer didn't have hose on it, so it went straight in front of the fire building, and a hose wagon hit a plug, and they laid a supply line. Well, now we have a triple combination pumper where it's got a pump, a tank of water, and hose, and so we can do a fast attack. The FDNY had a rig called fast water, and with us trying to buy back 26 minutes, talking about 40 years ago, flashover was roughly nearly 30 minutes, and now it's 3 minutes and 40 seconds. More than ever, we have to be looking at how can we get water on the fire quicker. That might be if you're first due coming off the rig with your mask on, with your gloves on. It might be, a new hose load that we use because we can get water there quicker. If there's ever a time that we have to be able to apply water to a fire in the shortest period of time, it's here now. So, just everybody buying into that and being open to change, being open, the larger your organization, the longer it's going to take to turn that ship around. You don't just turn it on a dime, you know what I mean? And the bigger the ship, the longer it takes to turn it.
No, definitely. Okay. And in order to affect that change, individuals should be able to back it up with education, right? Because to me, that seems to be the wall where you, instead of moving forward, you hit that wall because nobody wants to either get outside their four walls of their organization and learn what else is out there.
Yeah. And you can't force people to do that. And like, if you're trying to change an organization where people are not getting outside their station, you can't walk in there and beat them down with it. But, throwing a short one-page article on the table, every once in a while, pulling up a video on something that somebody's, doing. Like recently I saw DC Fire Department was doing some roof rope rescue training. Right. Well, everybody thinks, ah, oh, that's just the FDNY. You say, hey, man, it's not just the FDNY anymore. DC now is doing some roof rope rescue training, and then throwing the video on the UL Modern Furniture and Legacy Furniture, and just get a coffee table discussion. And you know what? You got to use psychology. If they think because they're working in a big city fire department, they're the best. They don't need to hear how they do it in Atlanta or how they do it in Miami or Houston or wherever. Then you turn it where it's not turning them off. You know what I mean? Like you're just, you got to use psychosemantics. You got to be, sometimes you have to be professionally passive aggressive. If you're doing it for the right reasons to just open their mind to it. And sometimes you just got to spoon feed it to them. You know what I mean? Stick it on the cupboard above the urinal or in the bathroom stall type of thing. So, but it's got to be, going back to that one word on a sticky note in your mirror, patience. If you really care and you want to make the change, you got to be patient. You're not just going to go in there and get them to take all the nozzles off and put new nozzles on. It's we're some stubborn individuals.
Yeah, definitely. Okay. When you were officer, what were some of your non-negotiables when you were in command of whether it was a crew or whether it was your when you were a battalion chief?
I mean, just bunker gear. I mean, even as a chief, I wore bunker gear, even when I knew I wasn't going to go inside. I mean, it's just like that's what we wear. I used to teach recruits, putting on your bunker gear is like putting on a Superman suit or the Spider-Man suit, it like makes you tough. And the waist strap, I'm a big FDNY buff. I know they don't wear their waist strap. And for me, the waist strap is really just a level of discipline. It's just like you're dressed, that's just like you're, let's put everything on. If we're going to wear a tie, let's wear the tie properly. So really the non-negotiables is we're just not going to cut corners and be lazy. If you take a water can in and you need more than one water can, you want a second water can or we're stretching a line. If one water can can't get it, then let's put a hose line on the ground. And that's just an example of what I consider, like, I think a chief's job is to eliminate complacency. We're there to make sure they do what they already know they're supposed to do. It's just easy to get complacent and lazy. Well, let's don't pull a line off the rig. Let's just get a garden hose or, let's don't do this because really the reason you're not doing it is because you think it's going to be more work. So those are really my non-negotiables is don't be cutting corners. Just if you're going to do it right on the fire ground. And I think that, we have to be true to ourselves. You know what I mean? If you don't know, say you don't know, ask. It's okay. We're none of us are pre-programmed with any of this stuff. So I think everybody, the non-negotiable should be cutting corners on a fire ground, and it could be, be on a vehicle accident. You know what I mean? If we're going to cut on a car, let's crib it. Let's put an inch three quarter on the ground. Let's get a dry chem on the ground. If we're popping a door, let's, roll the window down or take the glass. Like just common sense stuff that we know we're supposed to do. We just like, we don't want to take the 5 seconds to do it.
A while ago, I listened to another interview that you did, and you mentioned how, the waist strap thing, if you saw a firefighter on the fire ground, you had no problems on the ops channel that you're working, the TAC channel you're working, you'd say, hey, such and such, fix your waist strap. When it comes to difficult conversations, if you're going to have the title of chief, you need to embrace that. Not all conversations you're going to have are going to be pleasant, correct? Like you
Oh,
sometimes have to be the bad person.
absolutely. And that was an example. And some people took it out of context. Like, like that's not my main focus at a fire.
Right.
But, I've always been like that. So, I was promoted to Battalion 2 January of 2004. So when somebody came on a job, it was just like knowing, hey, man, Chief Mike will call you out on the radio if you're not wearing your waist strap. It's not about the waist strap. It's really not. It's about the whole package. It's about if you're going to put your pack on, wear everything right. If you're going to button up, let's button up. Like, you know what I mean? Like, you know, Captain Pete Dern in Fresno, where he got burned was he didn't have fire gloves on. He didn't have his hood on. His ear flaps were flapped up. You know what I'm saying? And she, Donis, the chief, she took full responsibility. That wasn't his fault. That was the lack of chiefs not holding accountability of saying, hey, you know what I mean? Wear your stuff. Like put your stuff on, if you will. So, like, you know, I think when things happen on the fire ground, more times than not, it's a chief worried about the popularity contest and not wanting to have that hard conversation and getting somebody's ass. You know, so it's pretty simple because, you know, if everybody knows I'm worried about the waist strap, then they know I'm worried about everything else. I want your hood up, I want your flaps down, I want your helmet strap on, I want your fire gloves on, I want you breathing air. You know, no firefighter has died in the line of duty vertically venting a residential house when wearing full PPE. It's never happened. There is no documented line of duty death. And you know how many firefighters have fell through the roof of a residential house that was on fire? A large number have. So I'm not saying they haven't, but they survived because this our PPE is pretty powerful. And I don't want to get sidetracked on that because, you know, I definitely think we have some work to do moving forward and understanding our weakest part of our PPE is our mask and mask failure, so on and so forth. But like the hard conversations have to happen, and I've always had. You know, and that's why the weak, thin-skinned people don't want to work for me or work with me because I don't think it works for me. It worked with me. They don't want to be in my battalion. And you know, I don't care. I've never been into seeking validation. I don't care. I'm not here for a popularity contest. But you know what? Those same individuals that you know say they don't want to work for me or they see that thing. But when all they're done, more times than not, they say, but you know what? If I was trapped in a building, I'd want Chief Ike in command. Okay. So you can't handle me getting in your ass, but you're saying that if you were in a bad situation, you'd want me in charge. Well, what I'm trying to do is keep from having to be in charge of a bad situation by making you understand we got to stretch lines, we got to force doors for exit. You know, we got to use ropes in big buildings and we got to work, breathe air. And you know, like I want us to be aggressive, but I want it to be intelligent. And I don't want us to be complacent on what we're doing. You know, if you're out in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean and the seas are rocking, and you know what I mean, you're on a center console, I would hope you'd wear a life jacket. I don't give a shit how good you can swim. If you can't see land, you don't know which way you're swimming, you're dead. I mean, Chris Phelps is going to be dead if he goes overboard without a life jacket in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. But if you have a life jacket, you might be able to survive enough days until the Coast Guard finds you. So, you know, a lot of times people just don't understand some of the things are there for that one in a million. And the one in a million does come up. I mean, it happens and we have to be ready for when that one in a million happens, that we're doing the right things to make it a safer operation.
Chief, one thing that I always admired about you is your knowledge, how you can talk about a topic and relate to an incident that happened many, many years ago. Where did all that, is that all from just hitting the books, reading magazines, or just being the buff that you are?
It's all of that stuff. And you know, it's a life of obsession for the fire service. You know, and I'm less proud of it now than I've ever been. You know, I wake up and go to bed thinking about the fire department. I literally do. I wake up and go to bed 7 days a week. I think about the fire service. It's what I've always done. You know, if my father could have done things different, and you know, 1951, instead of, you know, joining the Air Force, he'd have probably tested for the Chicago Fire Department. You know, he's from the south side of Chicago. So I grew up with a father that was obsessed with the fire department. I'm obsessed. I communicate daily with, you know, people that are obsessed with the fire service. My two buddies, Champo and JJ, you know, we go on buff trips together. You know what I mean? Like we listen to fire radio of different cities around the country of fires that we're not even going to go to just from home. You know, I 2 years ago when the brothers were trapped in that ship carrying hundreds of cars in Newark, New Jersey, Champ or JJ texted in our group about it, and it was happening live. Well, I'm in Colorado at my youngest son's on a national soccer tournament, and it's 10 o'clock at night, and I'm in Colorado with my wife and my youngest son, and I got it live on the speaker in my rental car because it's way more impactful the fact that I heard it live while it was transpiring, while it's happening, and they're calling for more e-hydraulic batteries for the because they had to have the portable tools because the cars had shifted and they were trapped between the cars. And so things like that just it makes it a lot easier to remember those details. Anytime I'm traveling, if I can go by an address, we were just teaching in West Memphis and we took a trip to downtown Memphis and we went by 750 Adams Avenue, Regency Towers, which was a huge impact on my career, 1994, and operating in elevators and high-rise fires. So studying the job since I was a little kid. When I mean studying the job, I've been studying it since I was a little kid, you know, fire magazines. I mean, in 1988, I was watching Working Fire and Kramer versus Kramer VHS tapes. Once a month, they'd get mailed to the fire department. My dad got them. He was a training officer. And I was watching VHS tapes in 1988, 89. I was watching 1988 or 89 is when Smoke Explosion Backdraft came out on VHS by Vincent Dunn. I watched them right when they came out in 1988, 89. Then Tom Brennan came out with his series on forcible entry, talking about eating a, you know, bowl of ice cream, as Tom Brennan referred to between the 6 pound act and the 8 pound acts. Like, you know, and I'd say somewhere around 1990, 91. I started 92, maybe I started reading the back page of Fire Engineering, Tom Brennan, every month, you know, from until he stopped writing the article, and now Champo does it. I read every month the back page of Fire Engineering. And so I tell people it's not going to sit in a 40-hour class. It's that one page on random thoughts. It's that one class that was, you know, 60 minutes long 30 years ago by Bill Gustin in Jacksonville, Florida, you know, on Through the Lock. I mean, Bill Gustin's the first guy that taught me how to go through a lock 30 years ago. So it's those little bitty nuggets of coffee table articles, little nuggets before the internet existed of just, you know, whether it was going to the Florida Fire Chiefs Conference and listening to Bill Gustin, you know, instructors coming up from the fire college. So, you know, it goes with the book Outliers, you know what I mean? 10,000 plus hours is what it takes to become an expert, and you're still really not an expert. In 2 weeks, I think it is, September 14th till September 19th, for 5 days, I'll be in downtown Philly at the UL FSRI Summit. It's the second one they've ever done. So I'll be hanging out with like-minded people from all over the country. You know, and it's we'll just be I'll be indulged in fire and research for a week. And that's all I'm gonna be doing. So I don't know if I really answered the question. Like, you know, I don't think you can just say, hey, you know what I mean? I want to know there everything is to know about the fire department. I think you can just want to be the best you can be, and you just study and study, and eventually you have a vast amount of information. But you know, I'm still disappointed myself when I don't remember something, or you know, I forget something. I have 80,000 photos on my phone. Every time I get a new phone, I get a 256 gig. I got a terabyte in the cloud. You know, so I take pictures all the time. Like just in the last couple of days, I was taking pictures of just like the whole the image of like the power lines and what different things are in the power lines, fixed fire protection systems, you know, because I used to know everything there was about the fire pumps, the jockey pumps, all that, because I was a fire inspector, and we did 10 years of HROC. Well, now for a couple of years we haven't done HROC. I feel like I'm getting a little weak on fixed fire protection systems. So lately I've been screenshotting just, you know, pictures of fire pump room just to make sure that I'm staying on top of that stuff.
Okay. In your opinion, which characteristic holds more weight? Years of service, education, work ethic, or on-the-job experience?
I mean, you know, I don't really think there's an exact one. I think your skills, knowledge, and ability is a combination of all of those. You know, I will say that experience, if properly viewed, analyzed, meaning after the fact you analyzed your experience, you truly lived the experience as a something you will not forget, is probably the most powerful. I would say things that I'm very, you know, I have very serious conviction about, that I'm very passionate about, is from my own experiences, whether it be good experiences or bad experiences. I try to do the best I can to be able to get a lot out of other people's experiences when I can. But, you know, there's nothing like, you know, your own experiences. I tell people, like, you know what I mean? Like, a chief should understand how long it takes to do a 798 cut on a built up flat roof of a 90-year-old Type 3 building. You know what I mean? If they've really never been on that roof and cut it at 4 o'clock in the morning, they truly don't have a clue. You know, they don't understand the tar. They don't understand the complications of a membrane on top of it, or they don't understand. Hell, they probably don't even know that the saw can only run for 10 minutes, even when it's completely full of fuel. 10 minutes goes by pretty quick. They might run out of gas if all they took was one K-12 with them. So I think it's all important. And I think, you know, education is important, but a college degree is not going to put out a fire, command a fire. It's not going to manage a mayday. It's not going to, you know, help you make an air pack last longer when your bell's ringing. But I definitely think formal education is critical, but people definitely should be seeking out, you know, as much experience as they can. If they're in a slow organization, you know, I've done a lot of fire buffing. I mean, I've done one buff trip to Detroit 15 years ago. I did 26 working fires in 4 nights. That's what I made it to, 26 working fires, where I just stood across the street and videoed them. You know, I'm not fighting it, but it's a real fire. I'm watching it burn. I'm watching it put out. And that creates calmness on a fire ground, because you've been to so many fires. It's like, we'll put this out. It's no big deal. So I really can't give you a direct answer, because, you know, like not just one of them is going to give us what we need. You know, you want to be Chief Vincent Dunn, you need all of those. So I think it's, you know, it's critical. But those people that are out there seeking every certification, you know, EFO, Fire Officer 3, but they've never really been to any incidents, never been to fires. They're just, it's theory to them. That's all it is. It's theory. So, you know, you definitely have to have the experience. I couldn't speak, you know, on the national level. I couldn't do 5 days at Battalion Chief Boot Camp, teach all day, every day for 5 days, if it wasn't for my experiences. And I've been fortunate enough. My whole career, I've worked in places that were busy. You know, people, you know, used to accuse me of, like, knowing the arsonist, and I paid them, and getting around, but, like, because it's like I've been a black cloud my whole career. You know, I mean, I've experienced over 50 civilian fire fatalities, but some of that is because I made myself available. Like, you know, I knew that if there hadn't been a fire in a few days and somebody wanted me to work a shift swap, I did it, because I thought I was probably gonna go to a job. You know, I track the average numbers. I look at the fire report from the state of Florida every year. I know that the highest percentage of fires in 24-hour period happens in 6 hours, between 1,500 hours and 2,100 hours. You know, there's times where I just took off till 3 o'clock and I came in at 3 o'clock because there might be a fire around dinner time. You know, there's, like, in the Florida fire report, it tells you what day of the week goes to the most fires, what month of the year. You know, so I made myself available for the big games. And for roughly 30 years, I was, a large percent of the time, was responding to fires from my house off duty. So I wasn't just a paid firefighter going to work 24 on 48 off. For 25 years of the Scambia, I had a take home car. For 25 years, I'd go to any working fire in a 3-county area, just self-dispatch, you know, and I would be instantly, I get paid overtime. But, you know, in the 90s, I used to go to fires when I worked in Pensacola. You know, like, we had a fire in Mel's Marina, huge, large, three-story storage facility for boats, where they're stacked three high, fully enclosed. And I just showed up with all my bunker gear, walked up to the incident commander and said, hey, you need some help? I wasn't even with a fire department on that fire. And I went to work for 5 hours at a marina fire that was historic because it had Omega sprinkler heads, and that was a big deal. It was a recall for the Omega sprinkler heads. They didn't activate because I made myself available. You know, I've been to a large number of, you know, multiple alarm fires that I was off duty and I responded from home and engaged for hours on end. And those are experiences, you know, that mattered. So, you know, you can't skip the game. You know what I mean? You practice all week and you want to be ready for go time.
Mm-hmm. No, that's a fact. Okay. With your fire service career, what do you believe was the best? What do you believe was the best position as far as rank that you've been?
I mean, I enjoyed being a battalion chief. I mean, I was, it's rare to do what I did. I did 21 years as Battalion 2. My call sign was Battalion 2 for 21 years in a very busy, poverty-stricken metro county. But I think, being a firefighter was the most enjoyable. Being able to go to a fire and just, you know what I mean? It being okay to be the one on a Halligan, taking a window, forcing a door, breaching a wall, cutting a roof. I love being on assault. You know what I mean? I've cut a lot of roofs. I mean, a lot of roofs, because back then, vertical ventilation wasn't really a big thing in Northwest Florida, and I was really pushing for it. And so there were chiefs that would get on a radio and say, "Hey, Ike, I need you to open the roof." I mean, they'd say it on the radio, "Ike, I need you to open the roof." And so, there was nothing like being on assault, being on a nozzle. The nozzle's the best position. I think that, that's the best part of the job. And I don't want my kids to fast track past that. But I don't want to take away that I did enjoy being a battalion chief. I did enjoy watching firefighters succeed, tactically support a strategy and have a great outcome. But firefighting's the best. I mean, being the firefighter, doing the tactical things on a fire ground, I think is by far the most fulfilling.
Okay. Now, back then, when you had the take-home car for 20 plus years, buffing, going to jobs that were in your jurisdiction and not, nowadays, what advice can you give for firefighters to find that balance? Because it's very easy for firefighters who want to be good at the job to go to conferences, go to classes, go to seminars, and subconsciously, they're doing what's good for their occupation, but they forget the family aspect was truly important. So, how do you find that balance?
I mean, I just, I think common sense, putting it on a calendar, like deciding whatever it is, like, how many, you're gonna go to two or three seminar conferences a year, picking non-negotiables, whatever it is, excuse me, picking non-negotiables, like whatever it is. If it's Saturday, Saturday's is family day and we're going to the ballpark and, we're going for baseball, football, soccer, whatever sport your kid plays, that day you're there. I mean, that's what you're gonna do. So I think the big thing is just finding those non-negotiables, if you will. Then, the balance of like, how does your family life look? For me, we had decided we went to engaged encounter before we got married, that my wife was gonna stay home. And so, I mean, she was a third grade teacher for a few years. She sold real estate for a few years, but 90 plus percent of the time she stayed home with the kids. So everything we owned, everything we had, everything we could do was provided by the fire service. And I was into teaching. I've been going to FDIC 27 consecutive years. I've never missed the FDIC since I went to Indianapolis. So you could call that was a non-negotiable. It's non-negotiable. I'm going to FDIC. And then my wife had some non-negotiables of stuff that, we're going to do. So I think it's just finding that balance, but I think people have to do what works for them too. I would never want anybody to, at home, say, "Well, this is what Isaacson, this is what he does, and this is what he did to get where he's at." I don't think that's fair for people, to do that, because maybe they're in a different situation. I've lived in five houses in the same neighborhood, literally four of them side by side. My house now I'm in right now is 4708. Next door is my cottage, 4710. My sister lives in the house I grew up in, 4712. I built a house across the street, 4717. Built another house just down the road. And, until my mom and dad died, like I grew up, my parents lived in the same neighborhood. They could help watch the kids if my wife needed to go, train for a marathon. Like, what's your family support? Organizationally, what are you doing? I think that there are a large number of people now in the fire service, and that they have this pipe dream that they're going to speak and make a bunch of money. They're going to teach at conferences and make a bunch of money. And I'm just honest with people. They're not going to make it. They're not, like, you know what I mean? If you want to make money, work overtime at the fire department, because you're never going to beat the overtime, a time and a half on a 24-hour shift. It's forever money. It's your pension money. Like me, I don't have 5 big years. I never took an hour in money. I always took in time off because I was traveling. But like, you know, there is no pot of gold at the end. You know, even those that made the largest amount of money in the fire service that were most financially successful, I'm positive that none of them were doing it for the money. The money just happened because they love teaching. They love the job. They made it their occupation. Those that were in the fire service that chose to have a business and build houses made a lot more money. And in the fire service, it's kind of ironic because you can make money doing anything, but just don't get paid to teach firefighting. That's not acceptable. You know what I mean? That's where you get beat up at the kitchen table. But I think that people have to have a balance. It's no secret. I charge a lot of money. You know what I mean? If you want me to come speak, you know, I'm giving up time away from my family, but I'm trying to make money back for decades of not getting paid a dollar, where I was like leaving my family and I was paying for my own hotel room, where I was sleeping two to a queen bed or sleeping on a couch or, you know, whatever the case may be. And so, you know, if you're going to a conference and you're an adjunct instructor, you have a program or you're teaching like at FDIC, that's awesome. You know, to get good FDIC and be an instructor, that is the pivotal. That's the top of the mountain. But if you've got young kids at a house and you're just teaching all these seminars to make $250, $300 a day, I just think you got to think about the balance aspect of it. Now, is it different once your kids are older and they're grown up and you're maybe retired? Absolutely. But on the other hand, I run conferences. You can't run a conference without having a bunch of people that are willing to volunteer to make the conference happen. You can't run a conference without having people being willing to work for 200, 250, $300, you know, a day. Even as much as FDIC charges, they still can only pay that and then make enough money for the business world to say, hey, this is profitable as a business, right? And I tell people all the time, see how many people run a conference and they don't ever do it again? It's because they find out it costs a lot of money. There's a lot of overhead and it's worth it. Don't get me wrong. But people don't think about the cost of the AV. Average cost is over $100 a gallon for convention coffee. In San Francisco, it's $300 a gallon. That's a gallon jug because you have to pay them to put it out on the tables. It's, you know what I mean? And I tell that just to educate the listener that when you go to a conference as an attendee, be appreciative for all those people, especially our CFT Green Team, the helpers at FDIC that are getting you on the bus, you know, the students from EKU that are there as an internship as a whole. I kind of got off on a rant with you, but I think that, you know, for your podcast, I think your listeners that love the job, my best thing to them is absolutely surround yourself with those people that want to go conferences, teachers at them. Just don't find yourself when your kids are little spending more weekends at conferences than at the ball field. And my kids will tell you, they're all adult age now, that it was hard pressed for me to miss a soccer tournament. I just didn't miss soccer tournaments. I didn't miss games. If you listen to anything I say, man, like I spent a lot of money. Sometimes I spent $1,000 to fly from where I was speaking to, you know, Hattiesburg or Gulfport, Mississippi or wherever to meet them there to go to one soccer game because I had to. That was just part of it. You know, I just flew to Gainesville, I don't know, a week ago. I was somewhere teaching and my wife just met me there because I told my youngest son I would help him build some cabinets, some, you know, shelves in his fraternity house. And so that's important to me. In October, I'm going to two different cities and I'm going to fly straight from New Orleans to Gainesville for the Florida Gators play Mississippi State in the Swamp. And, you know, my kids are going to be there. So, you know, I tell you that because there are a lot of things that you do. You make decisions and you manage your time appropriately and be there for the important stuff. I've rarely missed any significant event for my kids. And a significant game event was a soccer game, because everyone, something could happen. They could score a goal, stop a goal, get a shutout, you know, so on and so forth. And, you know, I always like to kid around and say, hey, my kids still come home to see me. You know, my kids want me to come to the fraternity house, the sorority. You know, they want me to tailgate with them, you know, at all the Florida Gator football games. My youngest son graduated, I'm bragging, but he graduated with a 4.0 biomedical engineering. Lowest grade he had in all 4 years of college at the University of Florida was a 96. That was an organic chemistry too. And he's a firefighter. He's in collapse school this week, I think, down at the Florida State Fire College, because he grew up around the fire service and saw how awesome the brotherhood is. And you're not going to get rich, but you can make a good living. And the fire service will take care of you, you know. And he could have been a doctor, could have gone to probably any med school. You know, that's what he interned was at Columbia Hospital in New York City. And that just showed him that he wasn't meant to be a doctor, that he, you know, he wants to be in a fire service. I hope I answered your question with that long rant.
Absolutely did. Absolutely. I loved it. Loved it. With your two sons pretty much going, not going, they're in the fire service. What advice are you going to give them to avoid some mistakes that, you know, you did?
Be patient, enjoy the ride. I mean, it's that simple. Just be patient, enjoy the ride. Don't, like, you know, I talked about on the scrap. Don't be worried about station assignments. Enjoy the station you're at right now. Get the most out of it. You know, if you're at a station like, I'll just say like Pensacola Beach, my oldest son is, he's assigned to Pensacola Beach, and he's with a phenomenal crew out there, phenomenal captain that I've had a close relationship with for 25 years. Is while you're there, maximize learning the extractor sled, you know, jet ski, surf rescue, understanding, you know, kids getting trapped, you know, from digging deep holes in the beach sand, fixed fire protection systems, high rises, you know, all those things, to where if you do become a chief or the chief of special ops, you have a background experience in that, because there'll be time that comes that you're going to come, you're going to get assigned to a busier station that's, you know, goes to more fires. But making yourself miserable on duty, worried about the what if station, is just, it's ludicrous, man. Like, just enjoy the ride, you know. Don't fast track it, don't rush it. The career goes by too quick. You know, I wish I could do it all over again. It goes by so fast. And it's just enjoy the moment, enjoy the kitchen table, drinking coffee, enjoy lunch, dinner, man. Like, you know, one of my favorite things, even as a battalion chief, is coming back from a job 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. They all know I'm going to eat me 2 peanut butter and jellies, because I got to repack my system in case we get another fire before sunrise. Is at 3 o'clock in the morning coming in here, even if it's for 15 minutes, just, you know, talking. Who else does that? What other job does that 3 o'clock in the morning, and you're drinking two, you're eating 2 peanut butter and jellies and a glass of milk? I mean, it's just like, enjoy those times, you know, the meals. And obviously enjoy the drills, because it is the greatest job in the world. And I think too many times, don't get me wrong, you should get all the classes you need for promotion. Just don't be in a rush to fast track to retirement.
Okay. Love that. Mental health. Anybody that knows who you are, what you're about, what the fire service means to you, knows the experiences that you've had. So with that being said, I think Chief David Rhodes has said it best. It's not always the calls. It's the politics in the fire service. It's the belittlement of each other as a brotherhood. It's because you want to be good at this job, you're labeled as you're too into the job, or he's ate up, he or she's ate up. What's your advice with everything that you've gone through personally to keep yourself like centered, focused? Because it's very, very hard at times not to just say like fuck it and give up.
My little 8-minute doc video last night was probably the best answer. Is don't be seeking validation. You know, don't be seeking likes on your post on social media. It's all cool to get them, don't get me wrong, like, you know what I'm saying, but like, you got to be true to yourself. And I think, you know, mindfulness, like, you know, like, thinking about where you are in the moment, enjoying the moment. You know, and I worked for a boss, the same boss for 16 years that never liked me. You know what I mean? I got promoted over him, you know, back in 2004. And, you know, he was from within the volunteer system. I wasn't. And, you know, there were some good years and there were some bad years. But, you know, I'm at more peace now than ever. I kid around. I was incarcerated for 42 days at the IFFCOE, which is a phenomenal place. Anybody that doesn't know about it needs to educate themselves, whether it's for them or to recommend somebody to go there. But, you know, I would say just, you know, the key factor is sleep, man. It's like, you know, people got to sleep, you know, and I'm talking about deep sleep. I'm talking about REM sleep. I'm not talking about cat napping here and there, but just taking care of your health, you know, diet, exercise. I think the biggest thing for me the last few months is going to bed every night, sleeping 7 nights a week, you know, for, I mean, over 35 years, I've been subjected to get up by a radio going off, a pager. Even in high school, I had a minute or pager by my bed or a Plectron. In middle school, I had an old Plectron by my bed. So, you know, at least once a night, even if I didn't go, the radio went off. And over a period of time, that's going to catch up. You know what I mean? It's the what they call the death by a thousand cuts. You know, you don't realize it until your box is full, your filing cabinet's full. And I was fine up until I wasn't fine. And then you don't realize it. I changed my phone number. This Thanksgiving will be 3 years ago. I started self-isolating. I was putting up a pretty decent front on social media. People who are close to me saw at our conferences that I was less and less on stage. I was more and more secluded. I still love the job, you know, and I still love going to fires, but it got to a point where the pager going off was like I was like getting the shakes. Because I was just on edge too much. It was just 30 some years of going wide ass open, not getting sleep, running fires and calls and trying to buff all this stuff. It just took a toll. And you can't let yourself get to that point. And I think firefighters are so consumed with saving up 2,000 hours of sick leave to cashing in at 50 cents on the dollar. They're consumed with, you know, maxing out their annual leave. We're so consumed with what our retirement check's going to be that we're not even living life to the retirement check. And, you know, I'm not advocating abusing sick leave, but having 2,000 hours of sick leave and then you mentally becoming suicidal and having suicidal ideations isn't the right thing either. If you need a break and you need to disconnect, whether it's sick leave, whether it's annual leave, whether it's shift swaps, take a break. Even when you love this job, you need to disconnect sometimes for 2 weeks. I think it should be mandatory. Every firefighter should disconnect for 14 days once a year, like totally disconnect. Now, they might still like get on social media or something, but like not go to the fire station to where you get 14 days of just going to bed without any tones. Like my thing, I mentally put my phone on airplane mode at night because my wife's sleeping next to me. If the kids need something, they're going to call her. And I think that's real powerful too, is going to bed knowing I'm not going to have to get up, you know, in the morning. But if I could give one advice, it's every once in a while, take an extended vacation and just take a mental break from the firehouse. I mean, the best option is 24/72, but since we went to 48/96, it's been a lot healthier on the department because those that don't shift swap or take overtime, every time they get off, they're off 4 days in a row from the firehouse. They've already said it's a huge improvement. Don't get me wrong, 48 can be tough. And ideally, I think 24 on 72 off is the answer. And that's pretty much what the Northeast does anyways with their work week. But Gainesville, Florida went to it. We got more and more fire departments. Destin, Florida went to it. And all of that just comes down to rest, recovery, to be able to be there to perform.
No, yes, sir. That's definite, 100% facts. My department I'm on, all I've known was 2448. This past February, we went to 4896. To say I was an advocate for it, I was totally not, because I'm like 2 days at the firehouse. But I can tell you, like you stated earlier, some of the tours, some of the 48s are gonna suck, but man, you can't beat the 4 days. And for me, what I do now, is the app that alerts us for incidents. As soon as I leave work, I turn it off. So I
Yeah.
don't know what's going on for 4 days until I get back. And if it's big news, I might hear about it, but it's the best thing that I could do for myself.
And you take 2 days off, take 148 off, you're off 10 days. I mean, if that doesn't mentally reset you, I don't think anything is going to mentally reset you.
That's a fact. Okay. What's next? What's in the future for Chief Ike? I know for me, deep down inside, I'm waiting to see within a year or so a post that you're going to make that you are a fire chief somewhere. I truly believe that it should happen. I think the fire service would needs that. So what's next for you, Chief Ike?
I've never been interested as a whole in being a fire chief. I don't really want to be a fire chief. I'm not saying it's impossible. I'm not saying it's out of the question, but I definitely will be looking to after a year or so, go somewhere to work for the right fire chief, to be a deputy chief, a chief of special operations, a chief of training. I would just as soon support somebody else as the fire chief and let them go down to the city hall, the council meetings, and let me share their vision with the troops, out in the field, in the streets, work with the line battalion chiefs. I think my skills, knowledge, and ability, my tools would be best used, working operationally with line battalion chiefs or a training division. As a fire chief, really it's the fire chief you're working with, one, two, three, maybe deputy chiefs or assistant chiefs. And I just think I have more to offer as a deputy chief than I would as a fire chief. Not that I couldn't do it, but just to lead, mentor, motivate, keep on track, line battalion chiefs and a training division.
Okay. And I'm sure there'll be plenty of organizations, plenty of your brothers that'll direct you to great organizations to make that happen. But Chief, I can only say this, and I know you might not understand, but you have no idea what this means for you, for me to interview you. Since I've discovered podcasts and fire conferences, I've heard your name, and then I started listening to all your interviews that you had with Corley on the Scrap. I love your energy. I love your presence. Some may dislike how you talk directly about the fire service, but it's needed. Firefighters need to hear chiefs that are into the job, chiefs that have never forgotten what it's like being a backstep firefighter. So I truly just want to say thank you very much for coming on. And another shout out to Captain Clark Lamping, who made this possible. So I just want to say thank you, Chief. You have no idea what this means to me.
No, absolutely. No, thank you. And thanks for loving the job. And Clark's a great guy. I couldn't, my son, the oldest, was going with Sigma Chi fraternity from the University of Florida to Las Vegas for some fraternity convention. And so I said, hey, buddy, I said, well, Rob and Jody live there. I said, if you want something, if you need to stay at their house or whatever, they could pick you up. And also my buddy Clark works at the firehouse right by the sign that says "Welcome to Las Vegas," and it's like okay, and he knows them. And so long story, real long story short, I didn't let him fly on some like third rate airline that the other fraternity brothers were flying on something with cardboard seats. I said, "Bud, you're gonna fly Delta. You can meet them there." So my wife and I got him a flight on Delta, and he ended up letting Rob Fisher and Jody Fisher pick him up. Gave him a tour to Las Vegas Strip, and he literally skipped half the convention because he was with them, and he went and hung out at the firehouse and rode the rig with Clark, and had a great time. So Clark Lamping's awesome. He was a huge part of Aatrox. So you're a part of that group, man. It's that's what keeps all of us going is us that love it. Hopefully, just inspiring another person to love it like we do.
No, but I love it. Love it, Chief. Like I said, thank you very much. I've truly appreciated this conversation.
Absolutely. And you got my contact now and my phone number. So if you ever need me to come back on again or whatever, just give me a text, email, call me, and we'll make it happen.
What I'm interested in getting you is whenever you formulate that class about that leader that you were under,
Yep.
I will get with my training chief and see if you can come talk, because I think a lot of us firefighters would love to hear your perspective on that.
And you know what, the biggest perspective is just emotional intelligence, maturity, and just accepting that we're all different, we don't all have to be alike, and just learning how much exposure you can handle and don't expose yourself too long.
Definitely. Love it, Chief. I appreciate you.
Awesome, brother. Have a great day.
You too.
See ya.
If any of the listeners out there are or know of a great firefighter who embodies the principles of being a great communicator, goal-oriented, hardworking, humble, passionate, and professional, regardless of rank, career, or volunteer, contact me at studentofthegamefirepodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, stay focused, stay committed, and stay safe.